Thanks for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara-Byrne. On this Tuesday night, they've been making it work for more than four decades in the music business now. Doug and the Slugs lost Doug Bennett near 20 years ago now, but they're still touring and playing. And longtime member Simon Kendall is with me to talk about the early days, the death of their founding member back in 2004, and why the remaining members of the band decided to carry on in his honor and for the fans, of course. The Voyager 1 space probe launched at about the same time Doug and the Slugs did, all the way back in 1977. It's still out there too, way out there, some 23 billion kilometers from Earth. So what happens when an onboard computer system malfunctions? How do you fix such old technology so far away? Well, NASA engineers have done just that. We find out how exactly they went about it. It's a fascinating story. The Trudeau government is banking on tackling the affordability crisis, especially around housing, to try to reverse their steep slide in the polls of late, promising to build some 3.9 million homes over the next 7 years. That's about double the current rate of housing starts. So how will they make that happen? And is it too late to turn their political fortunes around? Housing Minister Sean Fraser is with me to answer those questions and more. But first, the Canadian Medical Association is the latest to sound the alarm over the federal government's plans to hike the capital gains tax inclusion rate in late June, saying it will hurt Canada's ability to retain and recruit doctors. That in the middle of a crisis in healthcare. So why is that? What's happened? Is the federal government aware of it? Can it be changed? We find out. We begin tonight with the ongoing outcry about the Liberals' capital gains tax increase in last week's budget. You can add doctors now to that growing list of Canadians raising the alarm about the changes. You'll remember in last week's budget that Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland announced that the inclusion rate on capital gains would rise from 50% to two-thirds. Now, the Finance Minister last week was very quick to point out that this would only affect, according to her, a very small number of wealthy Canadians and corporations. Have a listen.
Only 0.13% of Canadians with an average annual income of $1.4 million will pay more on their capital gains. For 99.87% of Canadians, personal income taxes on capital gains will not increase.
Indeed, 99.87% of Canadians will not see their personal income taxes increase. Well, it turns out that there's a lot more to it than just that, right? And calling out the changes now are the two-thirds of Canada's physicians who will see an impact. Here's why. Many community-based doctors have incorporated their practices and operate as small businesses. You may know that when you go in to see a doctor in your community. They also rely on their professional corporations as a means of saving for retirement, since most of them do not have employer retirement plans. Now, the exemptions that the government has announced do not apply to them. So, in other words, this change means money right out of their bottom line when it comes to saving for their retirement. So now the Canadian Medical Association says that that could impact doctor recruitment in this country and retention right across Canada, of course, at a time when the medical system is in crisis. The Prime Minister was asked about this today. He seemed to kind of dismiss the concerns.
We just don't think it's right that a student or an electrician or a teacher be paying taxes on 100% of their income, while others have the opportunities to use accountants and pay taxes on only 50% of that income. This is about fairness.
Yeah, I suppose. But this is also about the law of unintended consequences, which I think is what's happening here. Joining me now is the Canadian Medical Association President, Dr. Kathleen Ross. Dr. Ross, thank you. Welcome back.
Oh, pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I imagine when this was announced last week, and a lot of us were paying attention to the finance minister's words about this increase in the inclusion rate for the capital gains tax and who it would impact. And I don't remember the word doctors coming up at all. Did you have a heads up on this in any way, shape or form?
No, we didn't. And in many ways, this was a surprise that professional physician corporations would be impacted in this way. We've taken some time to have a look and understand the implications that this has for physicians in practice. And having a look at that, we understand now that this is a huge disincentive for physicians to start setting up a practice, looking at getting started in Canada, but actually also a real challenge to those that have been in practice and trying to keep the system afloat in a largely crumbling system of care over the last several years. This is a real challenge. And we look at the math involved for those that have been incorporated over the last 15 to 20 years and now recognize this is in the order of an 8% retroactive tax on physician retirement savings held within the corporation.
Right. Clearly, when you release a statement such as this one, it's because you've been hearing from your membership since last Tuesday. And this was the this is the collective response. This is not just a few people up in arms. This is a collective response that you're voicing.
Most assuredly. And I think there's different implications depending on what stage of practice that you're in. But at the end of the day, you know, these are not shady business practices. These are corporations that were set up, depending on your province, 15 to 20 years ago, in lieu of higher fees for physicians to allow us to build towards those retirement savings inside of the corporation, and to have this sudden change landed. And I think it's important also for folks to understand the really unfortunate part is that we don't meet any of the criteria for exemption. So the 250,000 capital gains exemption per year doesn't apply to professional corporations. The small business lifetime exemption increase doesn't apply to professional corporations. So we're talking about an increase in inclusion capital gains rate on the very first dollar that we extract from those corporate investments that we rely on for our retirement.
Yeah, I mean, you've raised many interesting points here that I think many people, including myself, weren't fully aware of. First of all, this has been encouraged, right? I mean, physicians have been encouraged to set up in this way because it makes sense financially. But maybe if you could walk me through, hypothetically, you're someone who set up your business 20 years ago in this way, you were encouraged by the government to do this because, again, it allows you to charge lower fees. What happens? How does the impact of this change hit that individual physician or group of physicians?
Well, yeah, I could certainly use my own professional corporation as an example. I set up a professional corporation more than 20 years ago. I run my clinical practice out of that corporation. So from the dollars that I receive for my work, which in many parts of Canada is still fee for service. So you see a patient, you get a fee, you put that in your account. And then from that, you pay your mortgage, your rent, your staff, your supplies, your computer equipment, all of which have been subjected to tremendous inflationary pressures through the last decade.
And taxes, right? You're already paying taxes on this stuff, yes.
Alongside that, already paying taxes. From those dollars, I pay myself a salary for living expenses and to support my children and my family. And then from those same professional fees, I need to actually save for my retirement. So they've whatever's left at the end of the day, and I can assure you it's not much. We are definitely not the ultra wealthy that the government has set their target lens on. But I think that we need to understand that this is going to impact doctors for sure in their retirement, but also is a massive disincentive for new physicians to set up in Canada.
The retirement aspect of it is interesting because you point that out. You don't have a pension, right? I mean, you are essentially an independent business person as a doctor. So you don't have a pension. This is your pension is what you're talking about. So essentially, they've just, by upping the inclusion rate, they've just taken that money directly out of your retirement savings, essentially.
Exactly. And that's not any different really than other, defined benefit pension plans that people have with their employers where you make contributions. You can imagine the government reaching into one of those and adding 8% tax off the top. It's just not acceptable. So we need to have those conversations with Minister Freeland's office and perhaps just dive down and explain why professional incorporated practices should be excluded.
And you mentioned the disincentive aspect of this, because of course, one of the big issues that we've talked about before and that I've talked about with your predecessors in your position before over the past few years is just the difficulty in getting physicians to set up because of the paperwork and just the whole concept that you've explained of running your own business is onerous. And of course, with the pandemic and so on, there's been all kinds of different demands. So in many ways, this is simply just to come to add to a long list of issues that are already out there.
Yeah, there's no question at all that, and again, looking at our workforce that's actually beleaguered, morally suffering at the moment, and challenged, and many of the profession are already teetering on the edge of leaving the profession altogether, or shifting how they work. And as I said, this is a disincentive, absolutely. And physicians are smart people. We're employable in multiple other industries, and certainly this is this is going to point people in other directions.
And as you pointed out as well earlier, that one of the things that surprised me a little bit about this was the blind spot. I mean, there always is the law of unintended consequences with these things. But the blind spot here struck me as interesting, because even with the comments that I've seen in reaction to your letter already from the finance minister's office, it's as if they didn't know this. And that strikes me as being a bit odd. I don't know if that's the impression you have as well.
Well, certainly we didn't have a chance to comment on this process ahead of time. We're looking forward to the opportunity to speak to the minister now that this has been put down, to understand why professional incorporated practices are different and the impacts that this has. And it is far-reaching for sure. But I think we need to look at this in the milieu of a global health workforce challenge. We need to make sure that we are incentivizing and recruiting healthcare workers, not just physicians, but across the board for healthcare workers, to be able to meet the needs of Canadians. And this disincentive is not going to be well received in that realm.
Dr. Kathleen Ross is president of the Canadian Medical Association with us this half hour, talking about the impact that we're learning more about of the capital gains inclusion hike from 50% to two-thirds that was announced in the budget last week by the federal government, by Chrystia Freeland, the finance minister, and the impact that it will have on Canadian physicians. And we've been through the fact that physicians often set up as corporations, as Dr. Ross does with her practice in BC, and that part of how this works, like any small business, they pay themselves, they pay their staff, they pay their overhead, and they put a little bit aside for retirement. The thing is here is that when you go to retire, this is where the capital gains would hit. So it's sort of a direct loss on retirement savings and a disincentive if you're looking to set up your business in this way in the first place. So Dr. Ross, I mean, I suppose a solution to this would be an exemption for those in your situation.
I think that's one of the solutions, and certainly that's the one that we're looking for at the moment. I mean, the consequence of taxing and charging physicians more and taking away those dollars that we use to plan for retirement would be the need to increase the fees that physicians are charging right at the front door, which will increase the cost to already beleaguered healthcare systems. So really looking to roll this change back when it applies to how we save for retirement makes the most fiscal sense to us as physicians, and it should make the most fiscal sense to the government.
What has the reaction been so far? Because again, I think last week in listening to the way that it was presented, it was meant to impact affect a very, very small number of people. That's how it was presented. And now here we're learning more that it's going to impact different people in different ways. But the doctor side of this would be one that I think would be, if we go back to the law of unintended consequences, I would think that would be a significant one if presented to the finance minister in the terms that you're describing it in this statement.
No, I think that's a very reasonable summation. We need to actually look at what can and should be done to really encourage physicians to practice in Canada, to save for their own retirement, and to continue to provide that community-based infrastructure without which our healthcare system would collapse.
There has been, I mean, I've seen sort of social media posts by different physicians because this has sort of been bubbling around for a couple of days now, or at least almost a week, from physicians saying, listen, we don't mind paying this. We understand we do well. Have you heard that as well? I mean, are there exceptions here?
I haven't heard that. More than two-thirds of Canadian physicians have set up their retirement savings in this fashion. So to do this retroactive 8% increase seems unreasonable to most.
Right. And as you pointed out, you are in exactly this situation, right? So all of a sudden you're staring down 8% less on the savings that you've accumulated over the past two decades with a plan in place. I mean, the other part of this that seems interesting is the suddenness of it, right? The people like predictability in these things. And it seems like, at least for physicians, this was not predicted and certainly not consulted.
No, and as I said earlier, we were encouraged to set up our practices and save for our retirement in this fashion. So this is a step backwards for sure. I think it's really important to understand that the exemptions that have been put in place for individuals are up to $250,000 per annum per year, and the higher exemption rate for small businesses do not apply for physician incorporated practices.
Right. So even the things that were put in to try to mitigate some of the impact of this aren't going to affect you. Well, we look forward to following up on this and find out how the finance ministry responds to you. Thank you so much, as always, Dr. Ross.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Let's go back to federal politics ever so briefly now, because, you know, we spoke with Daryl Bricker, the CEO of Ipsos Global Public Affairs, on the show last night, and he was sort of hinting at, we knew this was coming today, but we thought we had talked to him early. Anyway, so today out come the actual poll results. And of course, as we mentioned last night, the Liberals were looking for a bit of a bump, right? They're trying to, you know, sort of kind of right this sinking ship, so to speak, because the poll numbers have not been good for the Trudeau Liberals over the past year, year and a half or so. So did the budget actually move the needle at all for them? Ipsos polling conducted exclusively for Global shows that voter reactions to the budget mostly range from lackluster to largely negative, go figure. In addition, asked about how they would vote if there was a federal election held today, 43% of respondents said they'd pick the Conservatives, 24% said they'd vote Liberal. So that gap is still 19 points. 19% said they'd vote NDP. With a few more details, Daryl Bricker spoke to Global News this morning.
We asked people, we said, do you give it a symbolic two thumbs up, a symbolic two thumbs down, or do you just shrug your shoulders? 17% said two thumbs up. 43%, actually 40% said two thumbs down, and 43% just said, I'm shrugging my shoulders. And then we asked them another question, which was, do you think this is going to help you or hurt you? And the percentage saying it was going to help them was about 10%. The percentage that said it was going to actually hurt them was 37%, so almost 4-1. So if the goal of the budget was to really give Canadians a very positive assessment about what the next 18 months is going to be like under the Liberal administration, it doesn't seem to be working at the moment.
Daryl Bricker, CEO of Ipsos, speaking to Global this morning. 37% of Canadians asked thought the budget would hurt them. 10% only said it would help. Of course, what they've been banking on, what the Trudeau government has been banking on, is tackling affordability and the housing crisis. And that's what a lot of this budget was about. Of course, we'd seen many of the announcements leading up to last Tuesday. They're committing billions of dollars to build 3.9 million homes by 2031. That is a huge number, considering where we're at right now. That is within the range that many say is needed to return this country to some kind of housing affordability. But just last month, housing starts actually fell over the month before. And while they're up over 2023 at around 250,000, I think, for the year, averaged out, that's half of what the Trudeau government is now promising. They're promising double that. How do you make that happen? How do you square that circle? How do you make those promises add up? We thought we'd put those questions to the Minister for Housing, Infrastructure, and Community, Sean Fraser, who joins me now. Thanks for your time tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's been interesting. I mean, it's been a week now since this was all rolled out. We'd had a lot of announcements that you took part in. Just your assessment about how things have landed, do you think, over the last 7 days with this huge focus on housing?
Look, my sense is a lot of people are talking about the housing plan in the parliamentary press gallery, the people who work in the housing sector, the community of home builders, investors, nonprofits, and the chattering classes who watch politics. But what I think is going to matter most is that ordinary people who live in communities across the country see themselves in the plan. And I think we're going to have to do more than publish a plan to achieve that outcome. We're going to have to show progress. But that's where the work continues. We now have to implement the various policies that we've designed. But my sense is we've got a plan that's going to make a meaningful difference for people who are currently feeling like they're priced out of the market or who have housing challenges in their families or in their communities. So by no means is the job done because we published the plan, but it's put us on the right track. And now we do our work to implement the policies that will have a positive impact on families across the country.
A lot of the MPs are back home this week. What are you hearing at the coffee shop?
Yeah, no, I actually spent my morning visiting a few different coffee groups. You know, it's the informal advice that you receive is sometimes the best and the most accurate. People are more concerned with what's going on in their own lives than the debates that take place in the House of Commons. People remain concerned about the cost of groceries, although they sense the prices have stopped going up at the rate they were. They know very well they're higher than they were a couple of years ago. People, even in the small town in Nova Scotia that I call home, see the very real challenge is around the cost of housing, which was not a challenge we had growing up in this part of the world. But my sense is that if people feel that the the government's focused on what matters to them. Do they have a doctor? Can they afford groceries? Can they afford a place to live? Are there jobs in their community? Is the environment getting the protection it needs? Then they'll have time for local representatives who care about what they care about. And I think it's important that we remain connected to those who give advice for free at Tim Hortons in the morning.
Indeed, yeah, all the world's problems get solved at Tim Hortons in the morning. Just to walk me through this a bit, because it wasn't that long ago, I guess it was August of 2023 that the Prime Minister sort of famously, and this was his quote was taken somewhat out of context because he continues it, but he sort of talked about the fact that housing wasn't really a federal responsibility, at least not entirely. We know that to be true. Where did this sudden urgency come from? Because I think a lot of us have known, I mean, you're in Nova Scotia, PEI had a huge housing crisis beginning about 7 years ago, a Liberal government there lost power because of it. Why this sudden urgency? Did the Prime Minister sort of, when he did the shuffle, bring you aside and say, we're getting killed in the polls here. You really need to do something about this?
When I was appointed, it was late July, a few weeks before the quote you mentioned. And, mm-hmm. and look, I appreciate you've pointed out that it may have been taken out of context because the next words out of his mouth were, though we can and we will help.
Yeah, although you know in politics, everyone remembers the beginning of that. And it was unfortunate for him.
Yeah, look, I remember it very well. But at the time of my appointment, it was very clear that housing had become a major issue. And let's not pretend that we had not been doing some work on housing going back a few years. But the focus when we launched the National Housing Strategy in 2017 was disproportionately on affordable housing for low-income families. You saw the return of investments after a 30-year hiatus in building out affordable housing stock by investing directly in the construction of affordable housing projects. What we saw in the near the end of the pandemic and since, as interest rates started to rise, as stock was bought up when interest rates were low, and the price of construction with an inflated cost of material, supplies, land, labor, and higher interest rates making it tougher to build at the same time that the stock had been bought up, was the affordability challenges were far greater, not just for low-income households, but for middle-class households right across the country, not just in big urban environments that were seeking to build 30 and 40 story apartment buildings, but in small towns and rural communities too. And what we saw leading up to cabinet shuffle that put me in this particular position was a heightened concern in communities right across the country. So I got to work literally within days of that appointment. Actually, the day I found out what job I would have, I bought a laptop and started typing out the first version of the what's now the housing plan. Right. Of course, many others fed into that process, other cabinet colleagues, my team in Ottawa, and people from across the country. But the attitude during that first conversation with the Prime Minister was, we need to step up our ambition to meet the moment to serve Canadians and to demonstrate to them we understand their challenges and are willing to lead the way. So that was the task that was handed to me, and hopefully the plan that we've released over the last number of weeks is up to the task.
It's awfully ambitious. I mean, I was surprised to see a number, and I was surprised to see a target that high, to be honest, because we had the CMHC on the week before, their chief economist, talking about how housing starts had fallen in the month of March. And then you've come out and said, actually, we're going to build nearly 4 million homes in the next 7 years. I know that's simplified a little bit. But why such an ambitious target? And how do you meet that? Because I think anyone who watches this space as closely as we all have over the past while knows that, in fact, housing starts have fallen, and for all the reasons you were just talking about.
Yeah, so let's look at the data that you just referred to with starts falling in March. They fell compared to February, but February performed expectations. March this year compared to where we were at in March of last year, it's actually up 16%. Right. So we can't focus necessarily just on the week to week or month to month.
No. But you're talking about doubling them though, Minister. Like, this is a doubling, and I don't think we're going up, but we're not on that path.
And we need to set the ambition that high if our goal is to solve the crisis. If we want to play around the margins, we can talk about incremental growth, but we have to fundamentally change the way that homes are built. We need to do that by reducing the cost of home building. We need to incentivize communities to make it easier to build homes and faster to get permits. And we need to dramatically ramp up the home building industry, not just in terms of adding more workers to the economy, though we must do that, but we have to incentivize home building and factories as different markets around the world have embraced, because we actually today can build twice as fast in a factory setting with businesses that already exist exist, and we need to help them scale up. So it's not lost on me that this is an ambitious target, but we set out with a vision to solve the housing crisis, and this is what we believe it's going to take through a mix of measures that will ramp up the speed of construction, but also measures that will help people get into the market if they're looking to buy, or offer protections to them if they wish to rent. So it's not easy, but the things worth doing, I find, are never easy, and we want it to strive for ambition, and that ambition includes a desire to solve the crisis, and that's what we think it would take, and we work backwards from there.
Sean Fraser is the Minister for Housing, Infrastructure and Communities. He's with us this half hour from Nova Scotia. We're talking about last week's budget and all the housing plans that were unveiled in it, at least the money around it. There'd been a big national housing strategy unveiled on the Friday prior. Minister Fraser, it was interesting listening to you talk about coming in, deciding to run in 2015. And, you know, Peter McKay was on the show recently talking about Brian Mulroney. His father was the Central Nova MP, I think, for a long time. That was a blue seat for the longest of times. And then you come in 2015 and are part of that big red wave that takes over the country. And Justin Trudeau becomes prime minister. And something that you said in a podcast interested me, which was you sort of saw this as a way to make sure that there was a promising future for your generation, essentially, a millennial, right? What's happened in the last 8 years or 9 years? Because it feels like that's who's been lost to this government over that period of time, and for a number of reasons, but it feels like that's who's angry right now. That's who's been left behind. And I was just curious on your thoughts about what do you think has happened over the last 9 years?
You know, it's funny, some of the names that you mentioned. Peter lives in the community now. We drop our kids off at school. I got an
Right.
8-year-old and a 2-year-old. And Brian Mulroney was the MP when I was born here. He actually, over the course of the pandemic, became a bit of a personal friend and an advisor, and has not led me astray before his passing very recently. But look, your question's an important one. Let's not talk about young people like they're a political problem to be solved. They're people who deserve the same level of service that every other generation has received from governments. And we need to pay attention to the very real issues that are impacting the quality of life that they get to enjoy. When I think about the impact of global events on a generation of Canadians, sort of my age and younger, I'm one of the handful of cabinet ministers, at least for a few weeks more, who's still in his 30s.
That's right.
There's a lot of people graduated into an economy that started with the global financial crisis, which had a detrimental impact on opportunities in the not too distant past. Fast forward to the COVID-19 pandemic, and the economy literally shut down for a couple of years, which created severe consequences for young people who were earlier in their career or are starting to move up the ranks a little bit, where they lost opportunities for a career progression. They may not have had opportunities to get hired out of school, and only now are getting back to the workplace in a stable employment scenario, but may still lack some of the opportunities that would have come by being on a job site or in an office where people were seeing each other face to face every day. The changing nature of the economy at the same time that the cost of everything had increased, put an awful lot of young people who didn't have significant life savings to fall back on, in a position where they're not only missing out on those career progression opportunities, increasing the opportunities to increase their earning capacity, what money they do have is being eaten up significantly by the cost of housing. The extra bit they have over is going to the cost of groceries. And when people don't have an opportunity to grab a bite to eat or go for a drink with their friends or buy a coffee in the middle of the day because they're worried about making rent, it's obvious why they're feeling anxious. It's obvious why they're feeling angry at the lack of opportunities. It's because things are happening in the world that have worked against them. Now, I think we can address those anxieties. Some will involve measures that will help in the short term. Some, I think we have to be honest, will take a little bit of time to solve. But I think at the very least, what we owe essentially everyone in Canada, my age and younger, is an opportunity to see themselves in the plan for Canada in the next couple of years. The housing plan is a big part of that. The recent budget is a big part of that. But people just want a fair shake. They're not asking for anything that other generations didn't have. And I think if you go to work in this country, you should be able to afford a place to live and be able to afford to have a family and have fun with your friends once in a while. That's an essential ingredient for the Canada we want to help build.
You were talking earlier about going down to the coffee shop, which is sort of an integral part of making sure you know what's going on in your backyard. Is the Prime Minister still in touch? Is he still in touch? I mean, I went to university with the Prime Minister, so I know him to some extent. Is he still in touch? Because it feels like he's kind of lost it a little bit in that sense, that he's not quite plugged in the way he might have been 7, 8 years ago. I just don't get the sense that he has the same ability to do what he did in 2015.
So, look, my suggestion would be spend some time with the guy. I've been on the road with him a little bit, and I'm yet to meet anybody in politics who is better in the room when he's face to face with people. I do think what you're seeing, though, is that across governments, when you have anybody who's been in office beyond the first few years, you're through a few election cycles. It becomes more challenging for the same messenger to continue to resonate with people who see the world has changed and want to see change in the policies governments put forward. But my experience working closely with the guy is that he's actively seeking input about what programs are actually going to meet people's needs today. He doesn't feel stuck in 2015 when I talked to him, and he seems to understand that the world around housing has changed. He seems to understand that the price of groceries is too much for working families. He seems to understand that a young person who's maybe graduating with tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt because they got a trade or a university degree and doesn't feel like they're able to get the start in life that they want for themselves. So from my perspective, when I see him, he seems like he understands the challenges that people are going through and has given me a lot of leeway to come up with a housing plan and made big decisions alongside Minister Freeland to actually fund the plan in a way that I think is going to make a difference. I do think it becomes more challenging the longer that you find yourself in government, particularly when people want fresh ideas. It becomes more difficult. But if you've got questions about whether he has the appetite to serve, try to get in the same room. There's nobody I've met who's better engaging face to face with people and understanding their needs as he seeks to meet them with new ideas.
Mr. Fraser, I appreciate your candor. Thank you.
A pleasure.
Off the left hand side, Bouchard to McDavid. Beautiful spin move, right circle to the net, back door, shot, score. Zach Hyman opens the score. 1-0 Edmonton. Hyman from McDavid. Hyman ahead for Adam Henrique. He'll finish his forecheck and create for Connor McDavid. Reverse pivot, dishes, one-timer, score. Zach Hyman extends the lead to 3-0. Arvidsson stopped at one end. Hyman buries his second of the night at the other. Hyman reversing to Draisaitl, guides it to Bouchard. McDavid right face off on tiptoe. 6-2. Hyman's got a hat trick.
Yeah, I mean, hockey must be the only sport where you can leave the rink without your hat and your $40 hat and with a smile on your face. That's exactly what happened in Edmonton last night. As you heard there, Zach Hyman picked up the hat trick. Connor McDavid had five assists. Can you imagine some spectacular ones at that in a big 7-4 win over the LA Kings in their opening game of their opening round playoff series? Now, Edmonton hadn't had much success in their opening playoff games over the past little while. I think they were 1-8 in their last nine postseason opening nights, but not last night. So a bit of a monkey off the back, and it was an exciting night. I think there was something like 1,100 hats hit the ice after Hyman scored that third goal. Cam Moon is the regular season play-by-play voice of the Oilers on 630 CHED. He joins us now. Cam, thanks for your time tonight.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
It's amazing sometimes you forget. Like, I watch hockey off and on during the season. I work at night, so it's not as easy. And, as the season sort of rolls through its 82 games, and then the playoffs started, it's like a different sport. You turn it on, you're like, the places are absolutely jumping. And Rogers last night looked like it was hopping.
Oh, it was unbelievable. Yeah, like you could feel the vibe in the city. When I walked to the rink in the later afternoon, people out on the streets, either going for dinner or whatever, just making their way downtown with the Oilers jerseys on. And yeah, there is something about playoffs, especially in our country. I know any American rink is going to be very loud and very passionate fans. And And I understand that. And they're like that. It's like that, you know, all the time, playoffs, regular season, very loud in a lot of ranks. But it's something about in Canada when it gets to playoffs, how everything gets ratcheted up a notch. And I've been able to see it, you know, whether it be Winnipeg and Vancouver. Toronto hasn't played at home yet, but, you know, it's going to be pretty loud there too. But, yeah, it's the from the anthem to the from the pregame warm-up to the start of the game, it's just it's absolutely electric. And last night was completely over the top. I mean, part of it helped that the Oilers had such a good start and really took it to the LA Kings early. But, yeah, it was very fun in the building.
Yeah, and it was amazing to see the hats come off, too, for the hat trick. Because I was reading today that it was the biggest, they think it was the biggest haul of headwear, according to the reporting they'd ever seen, like 14 garbage bags of hats, right? What other sport do you take your expensive hat off and whip it on the ice in celebration, right?
Well, exactly. And further to that, yeah, sometimes you get a hat trick and some hats get on the ice. Well, you don't get 1,100 hats on the ice. Like, they just kept coming down. Like, it was unbelievable.
I mean, just so I mean, when I think Kings Oilers, obviously I think back to the history, you know, the miracle on Manchester back in 82. This now I'm aging myself, but this goes back a long time. But man, I mean, I hadn't realized that the Oilers, knock on wood, haven't actually lost to the Kings in a long time in the playoffs. But that rivalry, especially with the Gretzky trade and so on, that there is a rivalry there despite the geographic separation.
Oh yeah, and that's what creates great rivalries, our playoff series, and the fact that the Oilers and the Kings have hooked up as many times as they have, and yeah, the miracle on Manchester in 82, and then after the Gretzky trade, LA came back to beat Edmonton in a 7-game series, and so that would have been 89, but then the Oilers beat them in 90, and yeah, it's just, there's been a lot of really intense and good series between the two teams. I mean, there's been a few. I think of that one in 87 that wasn't very good. The two Oilers rolled over the Kings. Edmonton was on their way to a Stanley Cup in 87. But, yeah, generally, there's been some great series. And I think of just even the last couple of years. And 2 years ago, that one went 7. It was very exciting. Last year went 6. And we'll see what happens here, game 2 tomorrow. But when you get playoff series, it just builds a rivalry. And the fact that, you know, Edmonton is, you know, a solid three and a half hour flight away from Los Angeles, that hasn't dampened anything as far as that goes. So, yeah, it's, and I know it's 3 years in a row. And I mean, I don't know that that's ideal in having the same opponent 3 years in a row. But hey, whatever it is, it is. But this one's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, that playoff format, I mean, there's a lot of complaining about it because it does create, I mean, it's good for the rivalries, but it creates some very familiar matchups year in, year out.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you go 1 through 8, are you going to get the same year in, year out? Probably not, but this way does help build rivals. You know, it's unfortunate that, you know, 2 years ago the Oilers played the Flames in the second round. That was very exciting for the province. I thought it was great for the province, quite honestly, because it was in the second round, so both teams were able to win the first round, get that momentum. And you just had people, you know, from one end of this province to the other, making sure they're either finding a way to watch the game or going somewhere to watch the game or going to the game or whatever it was. It's just unfortunate, you know, over the course of quite a few years, the two Oilers and Flames, they hadn't played since 91 when they hooked up in 22. So, yeah, it's, I love seeing the rivalries. This one with Los Angeles has been good. The Oilers, you know, last year with that series with Vegas, there's a bit of a rivalry building there, too.
Yeah. We won't look ahead to the next round yet. We could talk again. We could talk again. We won't look around. We won't get ahead of ourselves because there's another Canadian team waiting that could be a pretty interesting matchup if both those teams happen to go through. You know, they actually did polling, and you forgive me for being a news show host. They did polling on the playoffs recently. Angus Reid did. And of course, you know, Leafs fans, there's a lot of them, especially in Ontario. And they were sort of picked as Canada's favorite to win, but just barely in second place. where the Oilers are. Is there a sense of pressure on the team right now about, I mean, already today, I think the Toronto Sun was giving Mitch Marner a hard time. They won the other night, you know. There is, you always feel like there's pressure on teams. There's expectations on the Oilers, I think, this year.
Yeah, no, there is. And I think those expectations are warranted. Last year when they lost out in the second round, the team was incredibly disappointed. And you could see it in the postseason media availabilities exactly how disappointed they were. And I knew that it would be, you know, real strong effort from start to finish about getting back to the playoffs, even though the Oilers had a 2-9-1 start. Then they were incredibly solid after that, after the coaching change and Chris Knobloch came in. There's pressure. There should be. This is a team that in their cycle are, you know, they're one of the contenders. They're one of the teams that when at the start of the year, when you thought about teams that had a possibility of winning the Stanley Cup, the Oilers are in that conversation. And I think they, you know, after Chris Knobloch came in and the team took off, even had a 16-game winning streak, franchise best, that they remained in that conversation. And as we got to the playoffs, they, you know, most certainly are in that talk. So they're one of those teams. Yeah, they're a favorite in this series. They have home ice. They're looked upon as one of the better teams in the Western Conference. So no different than any other, you know, top-end contending team. There's some pressure there. But because it's in a Canadian market and the team is a favorite and is considered one of the top teams, that pressure seems to go up a little bit because that's just how we are.
We almost dare to dream, right? I mean, that's what it boils down to. Like, I remember even you know, I grew up in Montreal, and that's been a mighty long time. But anyway, you know, you kind of dare to dream, and you just hope against hope that it's going to be the year. What's been amazing, what I always found really amazing about Edmonton is that it is a true hockey city. I mean, you can tell just by watching it from afar that the place is just, I mean, you can almost feel the electricity coming off Edmonton right now.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And to, you know, even drive that point home a little farther, the Edmonton Oil Kings of the Western Hockey League in the last, you know, month and a half of the season were averaging over 10,000 fans a game for a team that wasn't even going to make the playoffs, which
is amazing.
Yeah,
they didn't have a good year. Yeah.
No, they were a team, and they're starting to slowly make their way up, and I think next year we'll be in a playoff spot. But they were getting over 10,000 people a game. You go watch the University of Alberta Golden Bears, a great hockey program, and you know that rink at the Claire Drake is routinely full or close to it. And then, you know, obviously the pandemonium that can be Rogers Place when the Edmonton Oilers are playing, and definitely in the postseason. So yeah, it very much is. This is hockey country, and this is a part of Canada that hockey's a great big deal, and I love that. And I grew up here, so I've seen it from all the way up, and it's incredible. Last night when that anthem was being sung, as loud as it was being sung, it gave me chills, and I was proud to be Canadian and proud to be from Edmonton.
Yeah. Well, we look forward to, I mean, I'm actually traveling tomorrow night. So again, not going to get a chance to see, but I'm going to tune into game 3. Cam,
okay,
we'll catch up. Thanks so much. Good luck tomorrow night.
Okay. Well, thank you. And I look forward to coming on again.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
MDS,
we have ignition. We have a liftoff.
Roll program is in on time. Vehicle response is normal.
There you have it. That was actually the launch of Voyager 1. We're taking you all the way back, if you couldn't tell by the Star Wars theme, to September of 1977, when Voyager 1 was launched by NASA. Oddly enough, Voyager 2, which is still up there, these two space probes, was actually launched a few weeks earlier in August of 1977. How long ago was that? Well, Star Wars had just been released that May in this country, and the Star Wars theme was the top song on the charts in September of 1977 with a bit of that disco groove. So we're taking you way back in time. Now, Voyager 1 was designed with the goal of conducting close-up studies of Jupiter and Mars in a five-year mission. However, its journey has continued, and the spacecraft is now approaching a half century in operation. Believe it or not, right now, it's about 23.3 billion kilometers from Earth. I don't even really know how to explain how far that is. It crossed into interstellar space in August of 2012, so more than a decade ago, the first human-made object to ever venture out of our solar system. It's traveling right now at about 60,000 kilometers an hour. Okay, so it was built nearly 50 years ago, and it's that far from Earth. How do you fix it if something breaks? Well, that's exactly what engineers at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory faced back in November when it started sending unintelligible code back to Earth. There was a computer issue with its onboard computer. But yesterday, NASA announced they actually are once again receiving usable data from Voyager 1 about its status. So how do you fix something so far from Earth that has sort of antiquated computer systems? Linda Spilker is the Voyager project scientist with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at NASA. Linda, thank you for your time today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
What a fascinating story. I mean, I sometimes forget the Voyager is still out there because I kind of remember when it was launched nearly 50 years ago. So, I mean, it's been out there for, 46 years at this point. What went wrong? What went wrong with it?
Well, one day we were communicating normally with Voyager 1, and then the next day, all of a sudden, we were down to just a single tone, and that the data it was sending back had stopped. And imagine trying to fix your computer or something if the screen's blank. You don't have any information.
Yeah, your 1977 computer, not needless to say, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. And so we tried, in the beginning, simple things like turning components on and off to see if it would reboot, see what might work, and then looking into the old memos and anything that we had, the historical information about what might have been tried in the past. And so we found some information and some ideas to try a little program that we put in, and lo and behold, we finally found a way to read out that computer memory cell by cell and find out what it looked like. And of course, we had on the ground a map of that memory from before the anomaly. And we found that one of the chips on board that memory had failed. It was a hardware failure. Could be just the age of the spacecraft. Could be a cosmic ray hit the wrong place and caused the failure. And so then it was work to figure out how to move the parts of the computer code that were in that section of memory, move them to a good piece of memory, relink everything back up, and get it to run again.
I mean, this, I gather, is far away at this point. And I don't want to call it obsolete because it's still running, but it's, you know, it's certainly, the technology is nowhere near new. How do you go about doing that? Because I think, does it take 22 and a half hours to send a message and 22 and a half hours to get one back?
That's exactly right. 22 and a half hours at the speed of light.
Oh, wow.
To send a message to Voyager, and then another 22 and a half, so like 2 days, almost two light days, to get the information back to the Earth. And so it's a slow process. It's kind of like working on a vintage car from 15 billion miles away. And so it's just a sort of a slow, steady process. And then you've got to find the experts that still know how to fix your or work on your vintage spacecraft and work on the software that you have on board, because it's not in a computer language. It's basically sort of like machine level code,
right?
And it's figuring out how to reprogram that code. And then, of course, Voyager's been up there a long time, like you said, 46 years. And so we don't have any more. The test hardware is long gone. It's sort of got old and broke, and we didn't fix it. And also any of the software we had to run the tests for the flight data subsystem, that's gone too. So it was eyes on, looking line by line at that code. And so Three different people looked through line by line before we sent it up. And once they were confident it looked good, we sent up the patch and kept our fingers crossed.
Right. So this is really human ingenuity in this case, because you need the people to decipher this, because the machines that used to do it aren't around anymore.
That's right. That's right. It took a lot of human ingenuity to figure out exactly what to do. And we had some of the best, you know, engineers working on the problem. And it was so interesting to hear them talking. They're all, this is fascinating. I've never seen anything quite like this. I'm really having fun solving this mystery.
Wow. So how did it, I mean, you explained it briefly earlier, but how does one go about fixing something that far away that is essentially using technology that we aren't really familiar with anymore?
Yeah, well, there is a flight team on Voyager, and that flight team includes a couple of members that go all the way back to the time before Voyager launched. And so it's sort of the corporate memory. We have a lot of memos, most of them in hard copy, and a lot of them scanned in to memos to scan through. And then a very bright young group of engineers, some of whom weren't even born when Voyager launched.
Right.
And so those two groups have combined to find the solution.
So I gather it is now sending back what you call health data, but not the science data yet again.
That's correct. We call it sort of the engineering data coming back. It's more the health and safety of the spacecraft, the temperatures, the voltages, the status of the little thrusters that keep the antenna pointed at the Earth. So it's a lot of status information. It's coming back at 40 bits per second. And that's not very much data per second. And to give you an idea, at Jupiter, during the first flyby, we had 115.2 kilobits per second.
Right.
So as the distance has grown, then the rate at which Voyager can send information back has really slowed down. And so we prioritize saying, let the first piece, let's get the health and safety back, check the spacecraft, make sure everything is working well, in case we have to tweak anything. And then we'll do the next part using the same process, put together another set of code in a new part of memory to start bringing back the science data. And of course, on the science side, we are so excited to think about what we might be seeing once we can w look with Voyager 1 again at data from the interstellar medium.
Yeah, because for people who may forget, Voyager 1 and 2 are still out there, and they're out there. Voyager 1, I guess, is out there far beyond where anything has been before.
That's right. In fact, these two spacecraft are boldly going where no spacecraft have gone before, to reference another TV
To
show.
coin a phrase. Yeah, dude, yeah.
And they've crossed, not only visited the four outer planets, the first to really do so, to visit all four, crossed through the heliosphere, that bubble created by the wind from the sun. And then there's a boundary called the heliopause, where the solar wind is balanced by the interstellar wind. And so we've crossed that boundary. In fact, Voyager 1 crossed that boundary over a decade ago.
Right.
And
I
now
remember
we're
that.
flying in the space between the stars, created by supernova explosions. When big stars get old, they explode and they create these bubbles in space of all of the material that gets exploded off of them. And so, in a sense, we're flying through what were bits and pieces of old stars, and there are cosmic rays out there, radiation, very high energy particles, of course, lots of hydrogen and helium, a magnetic field that's controlled by interstellar space. And so we're now just sort of dipping our toe at the very edge of this ocean of space into that interstellar space for the very first time.
Yeah, with these two incredible machines that were only supposed to last a little while, and here they are still there. How long can they keep going?
That's a great question. We're hoping to make it through the 50th anniversary in 3 years with both spacecraft. But with carefully managing the power, that's one of the key resources. Every year, the radioisotope thermoelectric generators give us 4 watts less power. So we're carefully turning off subsystems that we can turn off, and eventually the science instruments. And it could be into the 2030s. With some luck and the hardware keeps working, we could go with power management into the 2030s. But certainly it would be great to make it to the 50th anniversary of the launch of Voyager.
Wow. And of course, hats off to the team that keep it going, because as you mentioned, there's a lot of institutional memory, not just, we often think of sort of science taking care of itself, but in this case, it's the scientists making sure that it's still moving along and sending back stuff.
That's right. That's right. And Voyager is unique. We don't save any of the data on board Voyager. Instead, we are continuously sending back science data, like Voyager 2 right now. It's continuously sending back science data. And when we turn the high gain antenna to listen to Voyager, then we can get that information back on the ground. And we listen about 8 to 10 hours per day to Voyager 2, and we'll once again with when Voyager 1 science data comes back, and then use that to piece together and answer some of the questions and make some astonishing discoveries along the way. Voyager is still making discoveries even after 46 years.
Remarkable. Well, Linda, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Canada's environment minister said he expects the UN's plastic treaty will include a limit on plastic production. On the sidelines of the week-long talks taking place in Ottawa this week, Stephen Guilbeault said it wouldn't be acceptable to see a watered-down agreement that doesn't limit production.
They're very, very supportive of fighting plastic pollution. There are some conservative premiers and the Conservative Party of Canada who've decided to play politics with environmental issues, but I think that by and large, that's not where Canadians are.
Indeed. Let's make it political. Anyway, let's talk plastics instead. You know, every year the collective we, produce about 400 million tons of plastic waste. That's an exponential leap from the 70s. We could hit 1,100 million tons by 2050. And those huge mountains of plastics in our oceans and our landfills, they wear down, right? They do. They don't decompose, but they do kind of break down into these tiny fragments of plastics, microplastics, essentially, or nanoplastics. And they've been found absolutely everywhere, right? In the Arctic, in the ocean, in fish, and in us. And now research has discovered that the plastics in our food and drink can actually move past the barriers and into our vital organs, including the brain. Marcus Garcia is a pharmacist and postdoctoral fellow at the University of New Mexico. He's the lead author of this study that looked into this very issue. Thanks for your time tonight.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate being on.
This is a really interesting topic because I think we've talked a lot about sort of plastics, period, and of course the production. I've heard people refer to the time that we live in as the Plasticine, right, because of just how much plastics we've been producing over the last 70, 80 years or so. But this idea of microplastics and how they get into our system, that's interesting. I mean, that image of the credit card, I know there's some dispute, but that image of consuming a credit card worth of microplastics every week really does stick in the mind, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And I think you really hit the topic from the very beginning. I mean, as you said, you know, we've been dealing with plastic production. It's only been increasing since the 1950s. And actually, in terms of microplastics, we're actually seeing a doubling in the environment every 10 to 15 years. Even if we were to stop overall plastic production today, we're still going to be seeing that increase in overall microplastics in the environment for the near and future as well. So,
I think I know the answer to this, but where do they come from? I mean, we don't produce microplastics necessarily, right? We produce plastic.
Right.
Where do the microplastics come from?
Yeah, and that's a great question. And so one of the things to think about is, you know, we take perfect example, like you take a cup that you're using or a bottle or anything like that, or even any type of foodware that you're using, like whenever you go out to restaurants. After we're done with that, those end up in a landfill. And then environmentally, they start to degrade down. And after a period of time, these break down into these microplastics or small particles that are not only on the micro scale, but also on the nano scale. And what those do is they end up leaching from those landfills and then can enter into our water source. I mean, even at that, we see a lot of pollution throughout the world. So we see that those plastics in the water, I mean, in our oceans, those continue to break down. And once they break down from there, those from an agricultural perspective, that water is used to water our fields.
Right.
They end up in our plants, and then our livestock end up consuming those, kind of leading up to what we're talking about with our study is like after those are consumed, where do those end up? So as we're seeing, those end up in our food products, and then we end up consuming those. And then from there, we start to accumulate some of that as well, too. So that's kind of been the initial premise of why we designed this study is we not only wanted to look, are we seeing these microplastics, especially like on that upper scale, since we used 5 micron, are those translocating into other tissues throughout the body? And even at that, at what amounts? So that was a very interesting thing to find out.
It is because we've talked about this even on the show in the past, with relation to marine life, where we're finding lots of microplastics. But tell me a bit. So we consume these because they are tiny and they are everywhere, and they're in the food we eat and so on. I assume they're in the air we breathe at times as well.
Absolutely.
When they get into the system, when they get into the human body, what's their journey? And I think you found through your study that the journey goes beyond perhaps what we even thought it might.
Yeah, absolutely. So like one thing for us we wanted to do with this study is we were looking more from the GI perspective. So as we consume these microplastics, of course, you brought up a good point. Like we are able to breathe those in, and that, those are going to be future directions that we're looking at as well. But from our perspective, it was more looking at after we consume them, as they pass through the GI tract, how are they absorbed? And then just kind of following the path from there. So as you kind of saw in some of the images that we had, like we did show that it was in serum. Then, of course, too, as it enters circulation, also to the Leslie group out of Amsterdam had recently had a publication out where they showed the microplastics in the blood. So enters into circulation. And then, of course, as we know with that, we're going to go ahead and perfuse those other organs. And then that's where the overall accumulation starts to occur. And then biggest thing is we still have to answer, because with our study, yes, it was in a mouse model and it was only for an acute period of time, only over a four-week period.
With mice, right.
Whereas with us, I mean, this is a lifetime accumulation. And that is something that we are working on. So we are able to collect some human tissues and we are analyzing those at this time. And we also had another paper out recently where we identified microplastics from human placenta. So just to see the overall accumulation. And again, I mean, a placenta grows over an 8-month period. So just to see the accumulation in that period of time, it also leads us to ask that question about what's going on in our body over our entire life and seeing how that accumulation occurs, especially moving forward.
Yeah. Just tell me how you went about doing this study. I gather it was with mice, and what it is that you found that really stood out to you, because there are some things that were quite, I mightn't call them surprising, but they were certainly for the non-scientist, they were pretty interesting.
Absolutely. So biggest thing was, is we just wanted to see like, how are these plastics or where are these plastics actually traveling to within the body? And again, this was over a short period of time. So it was a 4-week study. And what we did is we dosed these animals at what we estimated to be the equivalent dose of microplastic consumption over a week that we would see in humans. So, of course, we dosed that down to the equivalent based off of body weight within these mouse models. So it ended up being 2 milligrams per week over a 4-week period. And then with that, what we do is we didn't want to do any type of inhalation studies just to kind of take that factor out. So this was where we specifically were able to get the microplastics into the GI tract specifically. From there, just isolated the tissues after that 4-week period. We did a digestion process to be able to adequately take away all of the biological tissue and just leave those microplastics. And then from there, we did the visualization so you can actually see some of these. And then from there, just kind of followed the journey with those and looked at where we saw them visually. But then we took another step too, is we then took pieces of these tissues as well and did what we call metabolomics. So we just looked at metabolic profiling, see how things were different. I think the biggest thing that was surprising, and we're still looking at identifying, and again, too, we are working with human tissues to kind of, one, answer to see if we're seeing the same thing that we did in this mouse model and comparing it. But the biggest thing that was surprising was that we were actually able to see these microspheres entering into the brain tissue. So that was very surprising. But also, too, just looking at the different metabolic profiles and how there was so much alteration in metabolism, not only from an enzymatic perspective, but also fat metabolism, hormone metabolism, those just really changed in such a short period of time. So, again, like I say, these were in healthy mouse model, but how those metabolic alterations can either lead to comorbidities moving down the line or even alter some of those comorbidities for individuals who may already be dealing with those kind of factors is something that we're very interested in following up with and just seeing what type of impact these microplastics are really having on our bodies.
Marcus Garcia is a pharmacist and postdoctoral fellow at the University of New Mexico. He's the lead author of a study on microplastics, and we're sort of marking, there's a big plastics conference going on obviously in Canada this week. Dr. Garcia, when you mentioned earlier the brain, and that's an interesting one because that really stood out from the article. I think a lot of the reporting is kind of focused on that finding. We didn't know that, or we didn't We hadn't had much proof to that effect in the past that in fact microplastics, nanoplastics could travel in that way.
Yeah, and like you said, this was very, very surprising to us. And of course, too, there is going to be continued research to look further into the brain. Like I said, with our group specifically, we are also transitioning more from mouse models and looking at human studies as well, too, in terms of being able to isolate specific brain tissues from autopsy patients or our decedents, I should say. Mm-hmm. And from that, being able to look, and this will also give us more of that longitudinal chronic exposure kind of outlet to right. look at. And
that's the big question, I suppose, for all
absolutely.
Of us. What is the impact? And I imagine the perhaps unsatisfying answer for now is we just don't really know yet.
Yes. And I think that you hit it perfect with that statement. Of course, microplastics research in the last couple of years has really come to light. So there's still so many unanswered questions. I mean, being able to identify like where they're at in the body, how they're translocating, not only are they there, but also being able to look at like, is there anything else that's going on with that? Like any chemicals that are still leaching out of those plastics. And I mean, a lot of research has been going into that. I know our group is really pushing, and we also developed a technique using what we call pyrolysis gas chromatography mass spectrometry, to where we were one of the first groups to be able to show the exact amount of microplastics. So usually we represent that in micrograms of a specific polymer or a plastic per gram of tissue. So we were one of the first groups to be able to do that, done in placenta tissues from human samples. And we are moving forward with more human tissues within to follow up like with this, with kidney, liver, brain, especially to be able to answer how much we're actually seeing in the brain, overall accumulation over that period of time. And then using that information for more of the demographics. So are we going to be able to link that back to certain instances of like social determinants of health? Yeah. What type of comorbidities do these individuals have? Of course, these tissues are collected from decedents. So is there a specific chronic disease that they were dealing with? And are we seeing any association with that accumulation that could be leading to it? But again, like you said, the research is still in the very, very early stages, but moving at a very rapid pace as well, too. So I'm really happy to be here at the University of New Mexico and with everything that we're pushing forward and what we're doing in terms of microplastics research. I definitely think that we're on the forefront of being able to answer a lot of those questions.
Right, because you mentioned even if we stopped all plastic production now, the microplastics that exist in our, or the plastics that exist already within our environment would continue mm-hmm. to produce microplastics for the foreseeable future. So this
absolutely.
Is an important question to answer no matter. And we're certainly not, it doesn't feel like we're on the cusp of stopping plastic production. So these are important questions to answer. It's been interesting that it's taken us a while to sort of figure this out. It hasn't been a conversation we've been having for a very long time.
Yeah. And I think another thing to really add to your statement as well is it's actually estimated that we have one ton of plastic per every individual on this planet. So just to put that into perspective and thinking about how all that plastic already in the environment and continuing to grow, how that's going to ultimately affect us moving in the future as well, too. So we always want to see what we can do, not only in being a pharmacist as well, bringing in that clinical perspective of what kind of environmental health outcome can we see from it? How can we mitigate that? And then also, too, from more of the clinical side is how can we work to have overall better health and be prepared for learning more about how microplastics are affecting us.
Well, Marcus, thank you for your for the study, and thank you for detailing how it all works. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate being on.
Doug came up to me and said that he was going to start a band. I said, is it a rock band? You don't look like a rock star.
More a carny than sex symbol.
You wouldn't be like, oh my God, I'm buying this record of this middle-aged man gotten fish.
I saw Doug and I was like, oh, that doesn't fit. But I was just so compelled.
You can't play guitar. It's not much of a singer, but they're great songs. Good luck. Could you please welcome from Vancouver, Doug and the Slug.
Play me tracks. This sounds good. This sounds really good.
The rhythm is infectious.
I was like, what kind of music is this?
Changing styles and genres.
Cultness as well as the everymanness.
What is Slugmania?
When things really started to take off, it was magic.
We were making money. People were happy.
I can't imagine how I physically survived it.
Boom. You have a national top 10 hit.
That's probably when the focus started to really shift towards Doug.
Yeah, that was a little bit of a documentary called Doug and the Slugs and Me, which was released last year, which charts the sort of history of one of Canada's most loved bands, Doug and the Slugs. You'll remember last week we had Canadian History X podcast host Craig Baird on discussing his search for the greatest Canadian song of all time. That's now down to the final 32. And one of the surprise survivors was a Doug and the Slugs track called Making It Work, which you heard before the news from back in 1983. The band was formed in Vancouver 7 years before that, back in 1977, by singer Doug Bennett, the Doug of Doug and the Slugs, who you heard referred to in that documentary, and guitarist John Burton. The music, as was mentioned a number of times, was hard to define. Distinctive for sure, upbeat, absolutely, a little bit of R&B, maybe a little bit of ska, some rock, a little bit of country, you name it. That's what Doug and the Slugs were. They would emerge nationally, and this is when I remember them, from a very young age, listening to them actually on 630 CHED, because that was the top 40 station when I was living in Edmonton back in late 79, early 1980. They would emerge on the strength of their first single, really nationally, and first big hit called Too Bad in 1980, which hit the top 20 in Canada. And suddenly, they were a band that people were talking about. It would lead to a record deal, a management deal. The band would have a string of hit albums and singles right through the 80s. But 1992's Terminal City would be their last release. And while members went off to pursue other projects, Doug Bennett would pass away in 2004 after a lengthy illness. It looked like that would be it, right? And you can imagine, what is Doug and the Slugs without Doug? But eventually the surviving band members decided to get back together and maybe give it a try again, both as a tribute to Doug, but also for the fans who still wanted to hear their music. So they found a new lead singer eventually, and slowly but surely they started playing gigs again. They haven't put out any new recorded records in a long time, but they continue to play. And they're actually out there again this summer. They're playing in White Rock, Cranbrook at the Rock the Kootenays Festival, the Pigeon Lake Music Festival in Alberta, Halifax's Rock the Harbor, to name a few over the summer. You can find them online. If you Google Doug and the Slugs, you can see where they're playing this summer. But it was great to catch up. I wanted to catch up with longtime band member, keyboardist Simon Kendall, who joins me now. Simon, thanks for your time tonight.
Nice to be here, Ben.
I have this vivid memory of landing in Edmonton in 1979 because my mom was working there at the time, and turning on the radio on 630 CHED, which was then a top 40 station, and hearing Too Bad for the first time and being blown away by it. You were one of the bands out there, although you always sounded different and interesting. And I was looking back, obviously, before we chatted, about what an interesting time the late 70s were for the band itself. And take me back a bit, because the breakout was really fascinating for a band that had been sort of that great story of being kind of a popular local band out west.
Yeah. I came into the band about a year before you heard us, and there had been what we sort of refer to as the proto Slugs beforehand, which was Doug Bennett, John Burton, and three guys, Drew Neville, Larry Lunchpail, McGillivray, and Dennis Henderson. And they were, you know, a bunch of guys from Kitsilano in Vancouver, and they had a band. John and Doug had put the band together. They struggled. Nobody would hire the band. They resorted to doing theme dances, which have become sort of a mythical event in the band's history, because no club would hire an original music band at the time.
Right.
So Doug had this idea to have theme dances. So they would put on Night at Coco Banana, for instance, and then everybody would dress up like Ricky Ricardo and put on their, you know, Brill Cream their hair, and the Slugs would put on goofy outfits. And they started selling out halls. This was all going great, sort of, but the band wasn't really gelling musically or personally. So that band folded in the fall of 78, and the recording lineup, which everybody knows as Doug and the Slugs, came together in December of 1978. I had gone to school with three of the other guys. We grew up together. We had been in and out of different bands together. And I got invited to join the band. And end of 1978, we were independent fully. We had no management, no record company deal. The clubs in Vancouver had started noticing that, where is everybody? Well, they're down at a Doug and the Slugs show. So the clubs right. actually came around and started to hire us. And then in that first year that we were together, we were selling out six-night gigs at several clubs in the Lower Mainland and in Victoria, BC, and getting a bit of a name for ourselves and doing well. We eventually, or not eventually, but in that first year, we had a handshake deal with Sam Feldman, who
right.
still had gone to school with the rest of the guys, but he was a lot richer and tougher than we would ever be. But he knew us personally, and he kind of, you know, heard about the band locally. And so he and Doug had a handshake deal. So we had a management deal, still no record company. And we put out an independent single, which would be the one you heard in 1979, mm-hmm. expecting, okay, we're going to, you know, do a 45 and we're going to sell it off stage for probably a buck and maybe we'll recoup our money.
Old school. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We had no expectations beyond that, but it was, hey, well, let's go in the studio. And we went in, made the record. We went out on what we fondly refer to as the Ball Breaker Tour in, I think, November of 1979. And we had saved up our ill-gotten gains from playing clubs. Sam wanted us to go out to the center of the universe, a.k.a. The GTA, Greater Toronto area. And he yeah. thought we'd get our asses kicked and, you know, get a little dose of reality. Plus, less cynically, he thought, well, you know, get some interest going with the Toronto market and with the Canadian record companies. And so there we were. We had flown on a red eye. We were borrowing vehicles. We were sleeping on people's floors. We were doing these kind of miserable gigs. But we got a write-up in the Globe and Mail, playing at Jarvis House in Toronto. And the next day, the club sold out and stuff started to happen.
Right.
And we were caught up in the excitement of actually having an audience in Toronto and Ottawa and Kingston and different places. And while we were there, the independent single that we had no real distribution for it. We'd asked this local record store. Remember those?
Yeah, I remember those well. It feels like with the 45 racks, it feels like a long time
exactly.
ago.
There was a record store in Kitsilano called Quintessence Records, and they were our distributor. Well, they had never distributed, I don't believe, outside Vancouver. And suddenly we had airplay across the country. They could not keep up with the demand for the single. We had a hit single, and we were ecstatic on the one hand, but on the other hand, we were, you know, push starting crappy vehicles and
not. Yeah, it wasn't glamorous. And, no,
it was far from glamorous. But that was where it all began.
I was trying to explain the music to someone over the weekend. It was always very hard to pigeonhole you, good or bad. You know, at the time, good because I think fans appreciated that. Bad because the music industry was so conformed at that point to, you know, you had to be, are you a ska band? Well, not really. Are you an R&B? Are you a tribute R&B band? Well, do you sort of, not really. And it was kind of hard, you know, everyone wanted to place you in a container, and Doug and the Slugs was always a tough band to do that with.
Yeah, I would say it's that identity or lack of or confusion over identity is a double-edged sword. In our case, it wasn't that we were calculatedly trying to be confusing. It's just who we were. We felt old at the time because we were in our late 20s. We had all these different influences. We had ska, reggae, R&B, some country, some singer-songwriter, some art rock. You know, all those ingredients were part of what every individual brought to the band. And we just kind of stirred it together. We called it Slug Soup at the time, but that's Indeed. Not really going to win you a lot of industry. Oh, well, great. Yeah, we've got the Slug Soup Band. Well, what's a major record
company? It was an acquired taste. I mean, at least outwardly, a bit of an acquired taste at times. Simon Kendall is keyboardist with Doug and the Slugs. We're talking about the band's rise back in the late 70s, early 80s. I was mentioning it was actually one of the first 45s I had bought. I bought many back when I was about nine. I sort of got into 45s, but too bad it was one of the first ones. Simon, I mean, a lot of us obviously think about Doug Bennett of Doug and the Slugs and his voice and just how unique he was in many ways. He passed in 20 years ago now. Man, how time flies. It doesn't feel like that long.
Well, yes, it will be 20 years ago this fall. Gone far too soon. We still miss him. There's no question Doug was the heart and soul of this band. He wrote the material. He became an iconic frontman. He was a very reluctant frontman, which is hard to believe for anyone who saw him after that first year, because he was very shy, very wooden on stage at first. And then he discovered the crazy person, you know, that he became as a front guy, and unique, I would say, in that he was fearless and took no prisoners on stage. He got in the habit of breaking the fourth wall, which we could go back and forth about, he and I, because I would say, well, Doug, you've written a lot of great songs, but we really didn't get to play too many of them because you were too busy going out there and messing up bald guys' hockey hair and whatever.
Right.
You know, he would go out and abuse the audience in a nice, friendly manner or not, but he enjoyed that shtick. He had a gift for spontaneity and for meeting an audience head on. We really did play a lot in bars and anything went as far as Doug was concerned in the bar. So
tell me a bit about the decision to continue on after he passed. Cause I know at the time, cause on your website, there's quite a nice tribute to him and about the idea that the band continued on in part because people wanted to see you, and also in part as a tribute to Doug.
Yeah. When Doug died, I just thought, well, that's absolutely the end of an era. And it was. I didn't ever anticipate that the band would return to live performance because he was such an iconic character. And it's about 5 years after Doug died, guitarist John Burton called me up and said, you know, Si, there's a guy playing in town and he really reminds me of Doug. And what do you think about getting the band back together? And I said, I don't know. But I said, if we can find somebody to replace Doug who does a good job of singing the material, and if all the five surviving original guys are in and the audience gets it, let's give it a whirl. And it took three tries. We auditioned a couple other guys who were keen, including the guy that John had seen, who had kind of the persona of Doug, but he really didn't have the vocal quality that we needed. Then Bernie Aubin from Headpins, drummer, who is also a classic rock agent, he said, you got to try this guy, Ted Okus. And Ted Okus phoned me he was living up in the Okanagan at the time. He called and said, I look like a cross between Benny Hill and Meatloaf. And
well, I said, that's quite an image.
I said, okay, this sounds promising. We had a little rehearsal hall booked and Ted drove down and he sang, like we launched into the first song. I think it probably was Day by Day. I can't remember for sure. And it was uncanny, absolutely uncanny. The five of us were sitting there going, wow, you could close your eyes and imagine that Doug was in the room. Ted had really done his homework. He had the phrasing, the vibrato, that quality, Doug's vocal quality, he had really studied it and emulated it. And we talked to Doug's family. They were on board with it. And, you know, I told the agent, I said, this is a big step for us. We don't know how it's going to go. I said, we may only ever do one gig because, you know, you can't anticipate having gone through, you know, been in the trenches with Doug for the 15 years or whatever that I was doing it, I just couldn't imagine doing it without him. Well, that first gig, it was a casino here in the Fraser Valley. 5 minutes in, I just went, oh my goodness, this feels so great. The audience loves it. Everyone's dancing. They're so happy. Ted's singing, just nailing this material.
A slugfest.
Yeah. And we have not done a ton of gigs in the 15 years since, but people have come up to us repeatedly wherever we play and they just say, thank you. Thank you for keeping the music alive. To me, the magic is that the five of us are the guys who made the records. And so we have that unique chemistry that we always had. And Ted just does an amazing job of singing the material. And I think it just takes people back and it really works. So,
Simon, thank you so much. I'll mention to the listeners where you're going to be this summer after this, but thank you so much for your time tonight. Good luck on your tour this summer as well. Are your dates that you're playing this year?
Yeah, we are going to be playing in, for those of you who are in the West, in the wild, wild West, we're playing at Blue Frog Studios in White Rock on July 6th, the really small intimate venue, and we do a show that we call Semi-Unplugged Slugs, Twisted Tales and Slug Trails, and some, you know, acoustic treatment and kind of behind the scenes stories. Then August 2nd, we're playing at Pigeon Lake Festival south of Edmonton. August 8th, we'll be in Thunder Bay. August 10th in Cranbrook, BC at Rock the Kootenays. August 16th at Rock the Harbor in Halifax. And we are so looking forward to getting back to the Maritimes. Last summer, we did a show called The Symphonic Slugs with the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra at the PNE in Vancouver. It was phenomenal. I got approached by the orchestra. I hired a guy. We did 20 songs arranged for orchestra with the band, and it blew everybody away, everyone on stage, the orchestra, and the 5,000 people who came out on a
song. Wow, that's a good crowd. That's a good crowd, sir.
Yeah, and we would love to play that show anywhere. So if anybody listening has a symphony orchestra in your town, call them up and say, please book the Symphonic Slugs because we'd love to come and play. Yeah. Hey,
Simon, once again, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Cheers, Ben. Thanks a lot.
I am grateful to all of you who have tried to feel my pain and share it with me. I do not know how to thank you who are supporting me at this crucial period of my life. I really appreciate it. I get the strength from all of you to go through this most painful journey. Your concern about my studies at UBC has really touched my heart.
That was a letter written by a friend or read by a friend of Romana Monzur from Romana back in about 13 years ago now in 2011. Her supporters at UBC were holding rallies in downtown Vancouver. Her story made headlines here, her native Bangladesh, around the world. And it asked this question. How do you rebuild a life? How do you rebuild your life after being blinded in an act of truly despicable violence? Mansoor was already an assistant professor at Dhaka University in Bangladesh when she came to Canada to do a master's degree in political science at UBC. She had a husband and a daughter back home. She went back home in the summer of 2011. From the outset, her marriage had been an abusive one. But she was going back at 33. She planned to get divorced and return to BC with her daughter to continue her studies and to carry on the new life, the new freedom that she'd found in this country. But while she was there, her husband attacked her. It was a vicious, vicious attack in front of the couple's daughter, gouging out her eyes, essentially, leaving her blind. You know, she was an assistant professor at a top university in Bangladesh. So this, and it also shone a light on intimate partner violence in that country and those trapped in abusive marriages. And so it got a lot of publicity at the time. And she even spoke out from her hospital bed, and it drew international attention at the time. The husband ended up dying in prison, actually, soon after. But with the help of the university and friends, she would return to BC. Doctors could not restore her sight, but she did pick up the pieces, eventually earning a master's degree in political science. She got a law degree in 2017. Her daughter and her parents would move here to join her as well. But now her story and all those achievements building her life back up is the subject of a new book called Out of Darkness, Rumana Mansour's Journey Through Betrayal, Tyranny, and Abuse, out today. It's written by award-winning Canadian author Denise Chong, whose previous books include The Concubine's Children and The Girl in the Picture. And Rumana Mansour and Denise Chong join me now. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rumana, I wanted to start with you because this is your story. And reading through the book, I mean, it's a difficult story to read. And I can imagine it was a very difficult story to live. What prompted you to think, okay, now is the time to share this? I want to share this story and everything that happened with everyone.
So the intention was there from the very beginning, because when I was actually going through this turmoil and then the darkest period of my life, I really wanted my daughter to know later what her mom went through, and the struggles and how she overcame that with the support of the community. So that intention was there. But then that's when I reached out to a friend who got me in touch with my agent. And then that's when the agent got me in touch with Denise. So that's how it worked out. But as you were saying, it wasn't easy reliving all that.
Reliving it all. Denise, tell me a bit about this partnership that formed and what your interest in telling this story was.
I met Rumana when she was months from graduating in law, having taken up an entirely new profession as a blinded student. And so clearly I saw that by then she had emerged out of victimhood, was no longer saw herself just totally as a survivor. She'd reclaimed the dignity and respect that she felt every person deserves. And yet I've got that headline and the traumatic events burning in my mind. So to fill in the time between that event and where she was now gave me an opportunity to probe and raise questions about domestic violence, why it happens, and how do abusers and victims emerge out of the social fabric, and why does it have to come to light when we suddenly hit stories like that break into the news, or worse, when suddenly there's a statistic of another murdered woman. Like, so I wanted to unravel that. And because it's now clearly a global and therefore Canadian problem, I think a writer's role is to try and air those issues, bring it to light. And an intimate story is the way in which to pull the reader right inside the story. And yet, in this case, not only be inside Rumana's relationship and what got her there, but to stand outside of it and think, what was my role as a member of society?
Rumana, just reading the book, it is, I'll be honest, it was more detailed and more harrowing than I expected it to be. I mean, there are really no details left untouched in this book about both how you grew up and your studies and your refuge in studies and your relationship and your marriage and how it begins. And of course, as a reader, the whole time I was saying to Denise, the whole time you're reading it, you're thinking, don't get on that plane. Was it difficult to share so much of your story this way? Because I think people know some of the details, but I don't think they knew all of the details that then emerge in this story.
I think for me, it was absolutely very difficult. I was telling Denise earlier that in the process, I re-traumatized myself because what I understood from her previous books is the more information Denise has, it's easier and it's better for her as a writer to understand the situation and to paint a picture for the readers. So I had it in mind from the very beginning. And that's why I tried to get into details of the incidents. And I guess that's where you kind of feel that it's a very visual rather than it was deliberate on Denise's part and my part. Like, I wanted to give her more information so that people actually can have an idea what happens inside the minds of the women who actually experience intimate partner violence. And Absolutely. When I was reading it, I understood that how traumatized I was at that time. And I guess in the process, I was really mad at myself that this is not me. Why didn't you stand up for yourself? So now it's easy to look back and ask those questions. But at that time, when you are going through abuse and violence, I guess it's really, really hard.
Yeah, and Denise, so, that does stand out. Oh, go ahead, please.
So, Ben, you know, my previous books have all been work in living memory, but this one was very different in the sense that memory carries many burdens, and so I had to approach my probing of Mormana's memories in a very differently from my previous books, because she called it re-traumatizing herself, mm-hmm. but I had to be very careful because I didn't want her to succumb to those memories. Mm-hmm. So it was a real balancing act on my part. And maybe that's why the book took me several years to do and required, you know, coming back at Romana after I had already been to DACA and interviewed family and relatives and colleagues and human rights people. So to round it out. And then also, which was not easy for Romana, I recognized, this is just as somebody who's empathetic, setting aside the writer, which are two different things. There was another person in the story whose voice by now is silent, the assailant's voice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the dead can't speak for themselves. So, again, you're doing a real balancing act. But at the same time, that person has to be present in the story. But I also knew that Romana comes out at the end. So though the memories are maybe tough, but in that accountability of them, you reconcile with them. And I think that's where the book ends up.
Romana Mansour is with us this half hour, as is Denise Chong. We're talking about a book that they've collaborated on, which is a biography of Romana called Romana Mansour's Journey Through Betrayal, Tyranny, and Abuse. The book's title is called Out of Darkness. And it really does look back at Romana's journey from her growing up in Bangladesh to coming to Canada as a student at UBC after teaching at the University of Dhaka, coming to UBC, and then going back home where she was attacked by her husband at the time and blinded, and then sort of built from there. And the book sort of charts the journey, a very difficult one, by the way, through that time, and then how she's come out the other side. Romana, it was interesting in reading it too, because I'd seen you graduate, because it was a big story in BC. And just when you look back at that time now, because there's a period in the book, of course, where you first realize you're not going to get your sight back, which is devastating to read, even though you know the story, right? But it just how when you look at the book, what would you like people to walk away thinking about you and this whole experience that you went through to land you where you are today?
The one thing if you ask me, I guess I talk about options, like which option your choice, the options that you have in life, and then it's your choice which one you choose. So I guess I want everyone to know, yeah, things happen in our lives that turn our lives upside down, but then do you want to stay down? And for me, I decided not to stay down. I decided to, as Denise mentioned, reclaim my identity. I wanted to celebrate my life. So I dusted off everything and then decided to stand up and then move forward. I guess that's the message that I wanted the audience to have, and it's possible. It just needs a change of perspective. Previously, I used to see a wall as an obstacle, but now I see the wall as a landmark that guides me to the right door. And a dead end is not, that does not mean that you are dead. It just means that you turn around and take a different path. Yes, I can't see, but then the community support and the support from my family and friends that I received made me a believer. And then I know now that I have lost two eyes, but I have gained thousands of them.
And you also mentioned earlier that you'd written this in part so that your daughter would know the whole story, because in the book, she's about 4 or 5 when this all unfolds in 2011, which would make her almost an adult now, right?
She is 18. Yeah. And she decided to go to UBC, accepted UBC's offer. So carrying on the legacy, I guess.
Yeah, congratulations on that to her.
Thank you.
Denise, I mean, one walks away with this. You're and yeah, I mean, Romana puts it well that it is not a book about despair. It's a book about kind of coming through despair on the other side. But what else would you like people to walk away with this from? Because it is ultimately a book about intimate partner violence as well, and recognizing it, although albeit in circumstances that maybe Canadians mightn't recognize as their own necessarily. But a lot of what unfolds, I don't think, would be unrecognizable to someone living through the same situation in this country.
In many ways, what happened to Romana is a textbook case of domestic abuse within a relationship. It didn't have to happen, I have to say. There was this great silence in her decade-long marriage. And as I taught, said, unraveling the circumstances of it, what did society look like from the outside? Was did it have to happen that way? Were there could life have hinged a different way? How do we regard violence in society? Why do we accept violence as an everyday norm? Why do we rely on the law to redress issues? Romana didn't get justice in Bangladesh. The assailant died in custody, was never brought to charges. But again, in maintaining that sort of what-if sense of the writer, what if has that sense in life too? Could there have been different choices made? Could there have been a different outcome so that we don't have to think that domestic abuse has to lead inevitably to these most, for Romana, a near deadly consequence? We want girls and women to be safe from the outset. I think in Romana's story, in the end, yes, she's resilient and she came through it, she reclaimed her life. But in the end, it's about dignity and respect, and there not being stigmas around any of our choices to be a full member of society.
And Romana, I guess a last word to you. When people put this book down, what would you like them to know about you?
I want them to know that losing sight did not mean that Romana was lost, I guess. I'm the same person who likes to celebrate life. And it's, I think my journey is a testament that human spirit cannot be defeated. And I guess that is what kept me going, that I did not want any evil intention defeat my human spirit. And I guess with the support of community and family, I was lucky to receive that, and prayers also. And I think it's really important to remember that. And this journey cannot be made without the help of family, friends, and community, so which I was blessed to have.
Well, Romana and Denise, I appreciate your time. Both of you, thank you so much. Good luck with the book.
Thank you.
Thank you.